On this week's 51%, we continue our series on endometriosis, a disease impacting roughly 1 in 10 women worldwide. Patient advocate Katie Boyce discusses her experience with endometriosis treatment and why we should talk more about life after excision surgery.
How long is it going to take for us to basically adjust to the fact that the disease at least is not as bad as it was? And that can take so much time for our body to kind of relearn how to do that.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. Last week, we launched our series on endometriosis, a disease impacting roughly 1 in 10 women worldwide. Endometriosis is when tissue similar to the uterine lining, or endometrium, ends up on places it shouldn't be outside the uterus. That tissue bleeds every month with your period, causing a range of symptoms that can include painful, life-impacting cramps, bowel issues, pain during sex, pain during urination, fatigue, depression, infertility, and more. As we learned last week, endometriosis is not purely a pelvic concern. It is a full-body disease, in rare cases reaching even the lungs. That said, there's a lot we still don't know about endometriosis. There's no definitive cause, cure, or method of diagnosis outside surgery. Scientific research on this is historically underfunded, and few doctors specialize in it, so patients are often put in a place where they have to advocate for themselves. Today's guest had to do just that, and now she spends her time helping others. Kate Boyce is a board-certified patient advocate, a chemist, and the co-founder of the Endo Girls blog, where she and her friend Laura tracked their journeys to diagnosis and eventually treatment. To be clear, Boyce is not a doctor. Her words should not be taken as medical advice, but she uses her experience to raise awareness of the disease, connect patients with knowledgeable doctors, and provide emotional support as they navigate the healthcare system.
My endometriosis journey really isn't all that unique. The unfortunate reality is that so many of us have these long delay in diagnosis, and we go through a variety of different types of doctors, and it can just kind of be honestly a nightmare process getting that diagnosis. So for me, my symptoms started when I was very young. I was in elementary school when I started having digestive symptoms that were pretty much just presumed to be like IBS. And those kind of progressed as I got older. And then I had your kind of typical painful periods, but I had a lot of other symptoms that went along with that, that just weren't being connected. I was told, well, you probably have lupus, but you know, your tests are inconclusive. I was diagnosed with supraventricular tachycardia. I had just a variety of symptoms. And so it was a constellation of symptoms, and it took almost 15 years before I received a proper diagnosis, and through a bizarre roundabout way. It wasn't even through an OBGYN. I just kept going to the emergency room, and I would have pain sometimes that would cause me to pass out, and it wasn't necessarily on my period. It could be before, and I would go and be told everything looked fine. Everything looks fine. I'd usually go and they would think appendicitis, as they're usually what the symptoms would be. And they'd say, follow up with your OBGYN, because they'd say, well, it might be that. And I would follow up with an OBGYN. I followed up with one who said, oh yeah, you just had a painful bowel experience. You know, I'll never forget that appointment. That's kind of what set me off, because I was just crying. So I was like, there's something very wrong with me. At the time, I was really fortunate. I bartended through college, and one of my regulars, he happened to be a chiropractor for a local major league soccer team in town. And he's like, you know, the physician that I work with on the team, he's really wonderful at kind of putting together complex medical problems. And he's like, he's diagnosed me with a rare disease. I know he is a soccer team physician, but I would really suggest going to see him. And you know what? I had nothing to lose. So I made an appointment with him, and I sat there, and this man was the first person to ever listen. And he looked at everything that I brought him, and he said, you know, you did not have a painful bowel experience. He said, none of these are normal. And it was the very first time I had ever heard the word endometriosis. I called him my Dr. House because there wasn't a lot of emotion. It was just very fact, like, okay, this is what he's like, I'm almost positive. And he was right. You know, he explained to me that at least during that time, the only way to get a definitive diagnosis was to have surgery. And he explained, you know, your doctor is going to be hesitant to do surgery because you're young. He kind of coached me through that process, and I couldn't believe that he was right.
So I'm assuming you were able to find a doctor who was willing to do a diagnostic surgery. That's kind of how we got here. But how did things go from there?
I went in and I had surgery and came out of surgery, and she said, oh yeah, you have endometriosis and these few areas. And I removed the lesions. I didn't know what she meant by that at the time. And she said, you know, you should probably take this, what we call the mini pill. And I said, well, I can't take birth control pills. I don't do well with them. And she explained, well, this one doesn't have estrogen, so give it a shot. And, you know, I tried and it didn't work well for me. And of course, you know, endometriosis, especially when it, you know, superficially removed, we talk about, you know, there's different ways of removing the disease. When just a regular OBGYN without additional surgical training and endometriosis goes in, they just kind of superficially, you know, shave off the top, or they burn off the top typically. And I definitely had my symptoms return quite quickly. And then it just, like, the reality hit that this is a devastating disease. And I had just been so focused on getting that diagnosis that I didn't even think about the long term of what it was going to mean. And my sister's 8 years older, and she was diagnosed, I think within the same month. We kind of went on this journey together, and she really took the reins on that and started searching out people who specialize in endometriosis. And so she found the surgeon that both of us ended up going to. She went, and then about 2 years later, I went. We flew from Kansas City to Atlanta, Georgia, to have these surgeries. And you know, unfortunately, we both opted to have a hysterectomy as well. But I always like to point out that, you know, a hysterectomy is not a treatment for endometriosis, because endometriosis, you know, doesn't reside within the uterus, right? So the lesions don't just magically disappear when the uterus is gone. So, however, it was a decision that I wanted to make based on just the painful periods themselves and my quality of life. So I opted for the hysterectomy as well. And that was about 6 years, coming up on 6 years ago.
So when you're helping patients navigate finding doctors or surgeons that they might want to work with, what does that usually look like? You know, if you have any advice for people. And in your case, I mean, you got a hysterectomy and excision surgery, but there are obviously other options out there too.
Yes, correct. So typically, if I'm helping someone, we can look at their insurance, like log into their patient portal and, you know, narrow down some specialists that are listed there. But when it comes to endometriosis, there is no formal designation of what an endometriosis surgeon or endometriosis specialist is. And additionally, there's no required additional surgical training for OBGYNs. So if they want to do additional training, they have to apply for a program to do that. And then within those additional surgical training, there will be some specialties, but there's none for endometriosis. So it becomes more like a personal interest of theirs. And so what we do is we look through, sometimes we still have to Google, and we'll look through different surgeons if possible. You know, sometimes there are online groups that we're very mindful and careful of when we look through, but sometimes we can look in a local community maybe and see if there's anybody that has been to a surgeon with good results. And so then we kind of make a plan on, okay, these are some doctors that we like. If possible, we will then try to do like a consult of some type, where we can kind of ask more detailed questions. You know, how do you approach the disease? There are different kind of schools of thought. So we like to see where they stand on certain things. Like, if I have endometriosis on my diaphragm, you know, do you excise it or do you just what we call ablate it, a superficial removal? You know, if I have surgery with you, will you even check my diaphragm? You know, do you believe that endometriosis can be outside of the pelvis? And so those are just some of the questions that we go through. We hope for a day where endometriosis becomes its own subspecialty, where there's a standardized training, but you know, as it stands, there isn't. So it's really up to us to kind of ask those questions. And so that's something I'll do, you know, and I'll sit down and we kind of talk about those different options. Another big factor is the financial factor. With insurance, there are codes that correspond to types of treatments. And so there's like one code for these gynecologic surgeries. It's like talks about removing, you know, lesions from the ovaries, basically. The federal government sets reimbursement rates for those codes. And so there's pretty much just one standardized reimbursement. So the common thing that you'll hear is that these doctors will be reimbursed the same for a 30-minute surgery as they would for a 3-hour-long surgery. And so because of that, there are a lot of out-of-network providers. There can be a misconception that they're only cash doctors, but if you have out-of-network benefits, you can try to appeal with your insurance to get some kind of reimbursement for that. But it's complicated. And when I'm working with a patient, that's a huge factor. So we make sure, you know, if you don't have out-of-network benefits, that's probably off the table, right? Like, that's just not financially feasible. That's okay. You know, we look through other options. You know, what can we do with what we have? And no, that might not be somebody's dream type of care, but that doesn't mean that you can't have an improved quality of life and we can't still find a really good provider somehow.
I know you can't give me an exact number, but if you could give me a ballpark, you know, how much do you see excision surgery costing in the U.S.?
It varies so much because just like, you know, everyone experiences endometriosis so differently, the disease is also just so different in each individual. So some individuals will have just a much more complex case that will end up costing more. I have seen excision with an out-of-network provider cost anywhere from just a few thousand dollars because they have great out-of-network benefits, all the way up to, I'd say maybe around like $20,000. Typically, if it's more than $20,000, there's other variables involved. And a lot of the time, that's not just the surgeon fee. So I try to explain the surgeon fee is going to be different than the other medical cost, right? That's going to be different than your anesthesia. That's going to be different than the hospital. You know, if your plan doesn't cover a whole lot, even in network, you know, you're looking at a much greater cost because the hospital fee is the greatest cost barrier by far. So even if you've got really great out-of-network benefits and it will work well for the surgeon, if those out-of-network benefits aren't great for the hospital, you know, you might want to look somewhere else because that hospital bill can rack up really, really fast. And that's when you'll hear these stories of surgery costing 50, 60, 70, even like $100,000, right? It's because the insurance company wasn't reimbursing a lot of those hospital fees. But when it comes down to the surgeon fee, I see a lot, you know, from a few thousand up to $20,000. And again, that has a lot to do with the complexity.
I guess with finances being such a big factor for some people, and, you know, I know there used to be a debate between whether ablation or excision is the best way to go. More and more now, the consensus is that excision provides better results. But I guess, have you seen any instances with patients where ablation is enough for them instead of having to go towards full-blown excision?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, a very hot topic. And for so long, we fought just to be taken seriously and just to receive better standard of care, which we still lack, but we fought so hard for it that there became a push where it was like, we need the most aggressive excision surgery available or not, like, or it just wasn't going to work. And it's nuanced now because, you know, there only used to be so few surgeons that were offering that kind of surgery. And now that we have, you know, more coming up the ranks and doing more surgical training, what we're seeing is that there are more that can claim that they're doing excision, but there's no, again, there's no standardized definition of what that means. So there's individual, like, doctors that'll excise just a little bit right at the lesion. There's doctors that'll excise wider around the lesion. There's doctors that'll excise the entire lining of the pelvis, basically, just to make sure that they maybe got anything they couldn't see. You get variable outcomes with excision itself. And then you get variable outcomes with, you have surgeons that'll combine, you know, they will excise the deeper, what they call deeply infiltrating endometriosis, and maybe they'll just a blade or superficially remove the what they call superficial endometriosis, right? Just kind of sitting on top. The issue with that is that, you know, it can be difficult to tell, is that actually just superficial endometriosis, right? Like, how deep does it actually go? And so there are definitely times where I've worked with a patient who, you know, they had to work within their financial feasibility and, you know, go to a surgeon that says, okay, I'll excise most of it, but there are times where I'm just going to just ablate it, right? And there are definitely patients who will have a good outcome with that. You almost just don't really know. So that's another part about endometriosis that's complicated. I was saying earlier, you know, sometimes the only symptom is infertility. Not all endometriosis causes pain. So it's really hard to tell, you know, what if the endometriosis that was ablated wasn't actually painful in the beginning, right? If that's the case and it comes right back real quick and it was never really removed all the way, but maybe that deeper infiltrating endometriosis was excised, right? Maybe that's what was causing the pain and the part that was ablated wasn't. And so it didn't really matter to begin with. Like, do you see how complicated it can be?
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, there is no cure here. You're kind of rolling a dice no matter what as to whether it's going to come back.
And even if it doesn't come back, you know, sometimes we'll go for another surgery. You still have pain, right? And it's like, why do I still have pain? And they'll go in and do another surgery and there's no endometriosis. Like, you know, they had it fully excised and no, there's no cure, but sometimes it doesn't come back in everybody, you know, it's like, or if it does, who knows, it might be there and we just don't see it because it doesn't cause symptoms anymore. But sometimes, you know, that happens and it's like, okay, well, what else could be the cause here? Because it's so complicated. But now when you're looking through literature, it's pretty much a consensus finally, that if it's deeply infiltrated, it does need to be excised out. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Even if it's not symptomatic, you know, there's something called silent kidney loss that can happen in endometriosis patients because the ureters can get so wrapped in adhesions from nearby lesions that kidney function just deteriorates. And that happened to me. I had a lot of flank pain. And so, you know, in that case, you know, we're having surgery to preserve organs. You know, we're having surgery to make sure that we're not losing some kind of function. And, you know, I think that could be presented better to patients who may be expecting full pain resolution. But the reality is that this disease is more than just, and I don't want to say just pain because that's debilitating. But, you know, endometriosis has the ability to really impact even organ function. So sometimes, you know, we have to go in for that meticulous, highly skilled expert surgery to make sure that our organs are safe.
We're speaking with Kate Boyce, a board-certified patient advocate for those with endometriosis. In your case, after your excision surgery and hysterectomy, did you see a decrease in your symptoms or did you need to do any more surgeries after that?
So my symptoms greatly improved, right? So I always had really bad bowel symptoms. And a lot of the kind of more bizarre symptoms resolved. And so this is like kind of a touchy one. For some reason, all of my joint pain resolved. And that was very strange because my joint pain had been so bad that I was receiving steroid injections. Who knows if that's just because we know endometriosis creates such a chronic inflammatory environment. Who knows if maybe that's what was, you know, attributing that. So I just had kind of like bizarre things clear up, you know, that, like I said, that constellation of symptoms. But, you know, we had, unfortunately, I had a partial hysterectomy, and that means that my cervix was retained. And there are some reasons why that might be opted for. We thought my cervix was totally healthy, and it's a lot shorter recovery. So we had left it. And then also I had an ovary that had an endometrioma. So if anyone doesn't know, that's actually considered a subtype of endometriosis. It is like a cyst that is filled with a super inflammatory substance that we think is components of blood, right? So typically you'll read about it and it'll be like, oh, it's a blood-filled cyst, but it's more complicated than that, right? They're indicative, if that's seen, that there's a lot of deeper disease there. And endometriomas have a tendency to come back faster than other endometriosis. So long story short, I did go back 6 months later. My cervix, I was still having kind of like a cramping sensation that was really, really, really hard on me mentally because I thought I was done with that. And I had right-sided pain from where that ovary had an endometrioma that would just be sharp and take my breath away. So, you know, I went back 6 months later and I had the ovary removed and I had my cervix removed, which is a much more difficult procedure than I realized. So the recovery from that was actually way much harder than, you know, my first surgery. And those symptoms resolved. I have zero right-sided pain. So for me, you know, that was absolutely worth it to remove that ovary. You could like draw a line through my abdomen and I have my left ovary that, you know, of course, with endometriosis, there's always adhesions and scar tissue. And no matter what we do and what we try, sometimes, you know, that will just always be there since it's a natural healing process. I have some left-sided ovarian pain occasionally, but the right side has absolutely zero pain, which just blows my mind. And it was a long recovery. You know, I wasn't prepared for the hormone changes after removing an ovary. I wasn't prepared for the vaginal changes from those hormone changes and the removing the cervix. And it's just, you know, I think it gets downplayed a little bit how intense these surgeries are. It's important that we realize, you know, okay, what are our goals for, you know, what do we want to improve? And so for me, the bowel symptoms was a big one, and that did improve, you know? So I think it's important that we look at a big picture and say, okay, 100% pain resolution is probably not going to be the case. What are we reaching for here? And then being prepared for the very long journey of recovery. We always have to say, you know, how many decades were you suffering with this disease? And how long was our body trying to cope with that? So, you know, how long is it going to take for us to basically adjust to the fact that the disease at least is not as bad as it was? Or, you know, our organs can now maybe function the way they were meant to. And that can take so much time for our body to kind of relearn how to do that.
I really appreciate that perspective because I do think when we talk about endometriosis, or a lot of other diseases, to be honest, you know, there's this narrative of like, okay, go get treatment and then you're fixed. Or there's so much emphasis, at least, on the run-up to that treatment or the run-up to a surgery that we don't really often talk about how long it takes to recover on the back end.
It's a huge problem. And I was that way when I started this journey. You know, I was that, okay, I want everyone to follow my path. But then it was like, I started to look at my path and it was really hard, you know? And then I start to talk to more people, patients in disenfranchised communities. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, this is a completely different experience for everybody. It's not just a, oh, I'm going to rush into surgery and be better. It almost became, because of the culture, especially online, like this thing where it's like, okay, I found an excision surgeon and I'm going to run off and have excision surgery and I'm going to be good. I've talked to other surgeons about this as I've gotten deeper into my advocacy, and we're like, yes, this may be routine for these surgeons, but everyone needs to take a step back and realize that a patient just running into this is not the way it should be approached, right? It's a very, very intense surgery, especially the more that we learn about pelvic nerves and just how interconnected everything is. You know, we're realizing that there are great implications to this, and it really needs to be, we need to sit down and have that discussion. And I like to think of it like this. I think a lot of the reason my perception has changed is because last year I had a spinal fusion. So I had a fracture, I had spinal stenosis, I had all of these issues. And I go to, you know, I seek out my surgeon for my back, and we did PT for a couple of years. I see a lot of parallels, right? He's like, okay, well, what can we manage before doing something super invasive? And, you know, I definitely am very, like, endometriosis is very pro. I'm very pro surgery, especially if something needs to be resolved, right, immediately. But my back surgeon was like, hey, you know, you're not in any sort of immediate danger with your spine. I said, okay. He's like, so we can try non-invasive if you'd like. And then he said, you'll let me know when you can't handle it anymore. So he was right. But he prepared me so much better than we're prepared for these excision surgeries. You know, he told me, he's like, this is really invasive, but in order for you to get the best outcome, I think, you know, from my personal experience as a surgeon, this is what I think is going to give you the best, you know, chance. And he prepared me. He said, you may not be 100% pain-free. He said, Kate, you've got to realize that you have spinal stenosis. And what we're doing is trying to preserve the integrity of that nerve. And that may not mean pain resolution. That may just mean some pain is better, but at least you're not going to lose bowel and bladder function, you know? And I really think that we need to be approaching these excision surgeries the same way. And then my surgeon prepared me for the year after. I had crazy symptoms. My nerves would flare up and be angry. And he told me that. He said, be ready. He said an entire year. He said, it will take your nerves a year to calm down after being touched. And I think about our pelvic nerves are just getting messed with during these surgeries. It's like, well, no wonder, you know, no wonder we have these bizarre symptoms and nerve issues and God knows what else, you know, after these surgeries. And I realized that that type of preparation made all of the difference.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for taking the time. Lastly, you know, in your role as a certified patient advocate, do you have any other advice that you'd like to leave for us?
Obviously, you know, I don't ever give medical advice. That's not my role. What I do say is, maybe you should make an appointment with your doctor just to make sure organ function's good, right? Because we do, you know, a lot of patients do end up with that silent kidney loss or kidney dysfunction. So a lot of the time it's like, okay, let's just look to see if structurally everything looks good. Your doctor gives you the clear, right? Because I want everyone to know, where are you right now, right? So what is your level right now? And I always encourage patients to work with a primary care physician, not just an OBGYN, because I think it's important to have that home base doctor that sees you as a whole person. If everything is safe and they're like, I don't want surgery, you know, then I'm like, okay, well, let's pull all of the options that are available. You know, maybe they just want to do pelvic floor physical therapy and see if that works. Maybe they want to try a birth control, which is usually, you know, they're going to have already tried anyway, usually with their OBGYN. And the doctor will know, you know, if they can safely take a birth control that contains an estrogen, right? Because there are contraindications for certain people with certain medications. So, you know, it's complicated, right? I have to like tiptoe a little bit, like, okay, once you have doctor approval for some things, then we can look at the options. And so sometimes they have to try a few different birth controls. And what I do is I sit down with them and we look at the type of estrogen that's in that birth control. We look at the type of progestin that's in that birth control, and they can say, well, I tried this one and didn't react well. I said, okay, well, the ingredients in this one are a little bit different. You want to talk to your doctor and see if that could be an option. Here are options that are progestin only. You know, you can do an IUD. Some doctors will suggest that anyway when you have surgery to place one if you have painful periods. And if none of those work, there are more intense hormone suppression meds that a doctor may suggest. And so we sit down and we look through the actual prescribing data. Because, you know, doctors are super busy and I don't ever want to just say it's their fault. They have restraints put on them by insurance companies. That's why another reason some specialists aren't necessarily in network with insurance, because insurance dictates the care. Now, the doctor may want to spend an hour with a patient to discuss something, but insurance says, no, you have 20 minutes. What we will do is sit down together and look through it, right? We pull the actual FDA data. We pull the actual prescribing data and we look through it together so that they can see, okay, this is what this drug is about. I don't feel comfortable with this drug. Or they can say, yeah, I understand that there might be a lot of risks to this, but I really want to try it anyway. And that's what it boils down to. As long as the patient knows, you know, what the potential risks of any medication are, then that's their decision, you know, like, okay, I may not agree with it, but as an advocate, that's not my job, right, to intervene like that. So, and it does go the same for surgery, right? But when it comes to hormonal, especially the hormonal side of it, they're also very intense. They get downplayed also. We get just tossed a pill. I've talked about this with physicians that they'll tell me, I will have a patient and I'll ask them what medications they're on. And they said they have to actually ask separately if they're on birth control because they don't consider it a medication. They're like, oh yeah, I'm on birth control. And birth control is a very, like, it's a medication, and there are implications to taking it as well. So I also encourage patients to always, always, always talk to their pharmacist. They know so much more about these medications. You know, that's their specialty. Your doctor may not have the time, but I've met pharmacists who will catch things that the doctor misses. You know, they'll be like, wait a minute, why are you on both of these medications? And the pharmacist will say, no, this isn't right. And I actually witnessed that the other day. I was in line and it was really amazing. It's sad that it happened, but I was really impressed that they caught that. You know, she went, you know what? I need to make a phone call because this may not be safe. I think it's really important that we have those discussions with our pharmacist.
Kate, Kate Boyce is a board-certified patient advocate helping patients with endometriosis. She's also a chemist and co-founder of the blog Endo Girls. You can find her story at endogirlblog.com or at endogirlsblog on Instagram. Kate, thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. A nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. Lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete, sweet.